Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Five Writers Talk. Thank you all very much for coming. Just a couple of things to say just before we start. After our conversation this evening, which will run for an hour and an hour only, we'll be taking a minute to announce the Racer Fiction Writer of the Year. We have a surprise announcement about this new award at the end of the evening. Stay tuned for that. Everyone associated with this event, and there's an awful lot of people, I'm not going to thank all of them, but they're giving their time for free. And it's something that often gets, I think, overlooked in a university setting, the fact that people do events like this and they actually don't get paid for them. So everybody on the panel, none of us have, I hope it's not news to you, you're not getting paid tonight. None of us are, and so I appreciate all of them for agreeing to do that. They're doing it because it's a very good school to work in. I've worked in many universities. It's not the case with all of them. This is a terrific place to work. I want to thank Dr. Pam Mergler for making a special effort to free this space for the evening. I want to thank the station engineer, NPR, Alan Fowler, and the music department's sound engineer, Justin Patton. I want to also thank our judges, more about them later. I want to thank them for judging the competition. I want to also thank Andrew Dowdy and Donna at the University Store for their generosity and for their warm support of the event, and especially for the Racer Writer. They're excited about the event, and it's great to have that kind of enthusiasm behind us. Please buy your books at the University Store. Don't go online. A real special thank you to our panel, Anne Neeland, Carrie Gerald, Squire Babcock, and Dale Ray Phillips. This is exactly what they dream about when they dream about wonderful, cosy Monday nights, is sitting in front of a microphone being interrogated, but it could be worse. They could be on the East Coast, right? And finally, I want to thank our wonderful and gracious host, Kate Lochte, for moderating this evening. It's a perfect time. I wasn't asked to do this, but it's a perfect time to become a member of NPR. There's a drive.
How lovely.
There's a drive on at the moment, I know. I listen to the radio myself. Over to Kate.
Well, thank you. And thank you for the questions. I'm dreaming them as pledge forms, you know, just so profuse. I think we should start off with one directed to Squire Babcock, Dale Ray Phillips, and Martin Roper. How do you stay inspired when you hit a wall and have writer's block? How do you keep going?
Reading inspires me probably more than anything else. It always has. It's what encouraged me to attempt to be a writer, and whenever I'm not writing or not feeling good about writing, all I have to do is read good writing, and I get fired up again.
Oddly enough, they'd be surprised to hear this, but students inspire me because they're always asking, when is something going to be out? When are you going to get published again? And so that puts the heat under me. And if I read a writer whose work I particularly admire, and if they're of the same generation as myself, and they're from the same country as myself, and I'm particularly envious of them, that inspires me. Pure, raw jealousy.
Right? Like everybody's been saying, reading and just finally just sitting down and doing it. You just sit down in the chair and finally just say, okay, I'm going to do this.
When students get frustrated with poetry for Anne and for Carrie, how do you help them appreciate it as far as digging for meaning?
Well, to start out, I guess I hate to dig for meaning, but I guess, you know, I would have to confess, just this very week, I felt like I was kind of doing that, teaching Hamlet in my humanities class, digging for meaning, because I had to do it in a class and a half, this great play, and I hated it, and I felt like a failure, which I think is probably the thing that inspires me more than anything, failure. But I think, you know, just reading poem after poem, I mean, I know I had one poetry workshop in college, and, you know, the regular professor was okay, but he went on tour one week, and this other guy came in, and all he did was read poems at us, poem after poem after poem after poem, and I can still tell you that the poems that I liked, and that, you know, I think just that experience of reading poems together sometimes does it. I think the internet's a great resource because you can hear so many poems aloud. I mean, Poetry Foundation, I mean, you can just get to the writer's voice so fast these days, and I just love to do that.
I would agree with Anne. I think it's important to let students know that that you shouldn't always have to dig for meaning, like you're saying. There's a really good book by David Orr called Beautiful and Pointless, and it's talking about contemporary poetry. And in the introduction, he compares reading contemporary poetry and feeling like you are supposed to find some kind of grand meaning in it. And he uses this wonderful analogy about Belgium and how you would feel if you were traveling to Belgium. And if you were traveling to Belgium, you probably wouldn't feel like you had this pressure to, I don't know, memorize the entire language of Belgium and to know all of Belgium's history and everything, but to have enough of a knowledge to sort of get there and enjoy it most of all. And then you become a little more comfortable with it. And so then you try to find out a little bit more. And I think contemporary poetry especially works the same way, that you try to find whatever it is that you like about a poem. It's the language, it has some image at the end that you just cannot get out of your head. It has a rhythm that you really, really like. And so you want to try to find more of that or figure out how exactly that's working. I think it's easier for students, I know it was easier for me, to come at poetry from a craft perspective before trying to figure out what the big meaning of it was, because I don't know, the meaning that may let you down. So
some of you in the audience may know that Billy Collins poem Introduction to Poetry, yeah. You know, where the instructor's whipping the students so sometimes that happens, I guess.
Well, there's actually a follow-up to this, and that is, how has contemporary poetry changed the way you teach?
I don't know that it changed the way I have taught at all, except then it's maybe more accessible. I mean, there are more contemporary poems read online, like we were just talking about. So students can find contemporary poetry on sites like Verse Daily, Poetry Daily, the Poetry Foundation. It's easier to get to it, so you can send students to more places to find it. But I don't think that I teach a contemporary poem that any differently than I would teach a Shakespearean sonnet or anything like that. I don't know, Ian, if you would.
Well, I guess I would say that maybe there's a little bit more emphasis on the oral tradition these days, you know, partly through poetry out loud, and there, right. You know, there are a lot of things going on that maybe push us in a slightly different direction. I know that it wasn't until fairly recently that I got into big trouble once in class for being too loud, a poet being rowdy, and it was on the fifth floor in faculty hall, and I had brought a bag of instruments, and I was trying to teach, you know, biblical free verse, you know, Whitmanic kind of verse, and some of the people from GLIA didn't like it too much, so I think we need to get some kind of special creative space so that we can get a little louder. And I think I've also had some students, some of you may remember B.J. Wilson, he was maybe the first one who came in here, but he had been on the streets performing himself as a poet and knew a lot about rap and all that. I've had several students who really were much better with the oral tradition than I was in terms of knowing rap and coming out of that mm-hmm. direction.
Thank you. We're almost through with the individual questions, and there are a whole slew for the panel at large. But let me go back and follow up with you, Squire. You said that your inspiration is reading. And in fact, we have a question for you that is simply, what is your reading life like?
It's a kind of chaos. My bedside table has two or three open magazines, a couple of books of recent recommendation to me or recent discovery, and then I have a stack of books that I intend to read within arm's reach. I spend most of my waking hours in the middle of the night doing my best reading. I wake up in the middle of the night regularly, and I use that time to read, and I think it's because my day is chaotic and full of all kinds of stresses and so forth, that's the best time. You know, I'm always reading all kinds of different things.
Well, I think I'd like to hear the answer to that question from each of you. Carrie?
Well, it's probably about the same as Squire's. I think, you know, if I had to think about what's the books on my various tables at home, I have Beautiful and Pointless by David Orr, and then I've got some poetry collections by friends that I want to read. And I like to read a lot of nonfiction, so I have several nonfiction books. And I love magazines. I like crappy magazines. And so I read a lot of those because you never know where you'll find material. So I read a little bit of everything. I also like podcasts, which I know is not reading, but it is getting material into your brain that's good. And so in the car, when I'm walking, while I'm doing the dishes, I will often listen to something being read to me. And I find that that's really good too.
Martin, how about you?
Well, I have two places I read. One is the bedroom and the other is the living room. And in the bedroom, I have the Bible, and I usually read that first thing in the morning and last thing at night. And if I have enough violence and horror, I put down the Bible. It's a joke. I put down the Bible, and I go into the living room. And I'm reading something now that I never read as a younger man, which is I'm reading a lot of Irish writers, and that's only because I'm teaching contemporary Irish literature here for the first time. In my life ever to teach literature, Irish or otherwise. And so the students here are pushing me. I'm asking them to come up with new names. And so they've been pushing me into writers who I'd never read, Irish writers who I've even grown up with. And that's fascinating to be reading Irish writers in Kentucky, and some of whom I've never even heard of. That's fascinating. And then my sister works in a bookstore in Dublin, and so she sends me books constantly, everything under the sun. And so I read whatever she sends.
Anne?
It's usually an eclectic mix. A high priority on my bedside table is the books I bought at the earlier MFA residency that I haven't made it all the way through or just bought there. I've got the Dog Years memoir of Mark Doty on there right now. I like to keep a number of anthologies there, poetry anthologies that I go back to. One of them is actually the Irish anthology that Peter and Carrie and Peter Murphy out in the audience and a few of us were on this. Mike Morgan, we're in a group where we worked on the new Harvard anthology of Irish poetry. So I've got that. I've got a fairly new anthology of Chinese classical poetry. I love, you know, Tang Dynasty poetry, things like that. The odd magazine, although I don't usually read literary magazines too much at night. But Ryan Van Meter's new nonfiction book.
Yeah. Del Rey, it's up to you.
Let me think. I do read the Bible. Let me think. I don't have a little stand by my bed, but I got books scattered around here now. Let me think. Last week I got through maybe 300 stories or something from New Madrid, so that was a bust week for read today, is the truth.
Yeah.
But doing some good stuff, I don't mean like that. And so now I get to catch up on maybe like, let me think, the Slicks that I got, or Harper's Esquire, Playboy, New Yorker, and The Atlantic. So I get to catch up on those, and let me think, I remember looking at the Who's In Them, and I'm looking forward to getting, Julovitz has got a new story in there. My buddy Singleton dropped by maybe a week ago. He gave me a new book of stories to read. I've read a couple of them because my buddy will copy them for me when he finds them in magazines and get them to me. And I can't remember the title, or I plugged the book, but I know it's got something to do with dogs. Let's see. And the Bible, I read it a lot also. Not as much as Martin, but.
You don't have need to as much as me, do you?
Okay, Dale Ray, here's one for you.
I just answered.
Huh?
This is unfair.
Hey, Kate, it strikes me that most of the reading we do is student work or work for classes. We read a lot. We read a lot of literature for classes and all of that. So when you ask about our reading lives, I think you have to say that that's we read for a living in a
huge
way.
Huge corpus of it.
Yeah. That's kind of the main part of it.
There you go. So back to you, Dale Ray.
But okay.
Where do you go, or what do you do when you have writer's block?
Well, for about 8 years, I drank. That wasn't too much fun after I kind of figured it out. But now I fish a little bit. But Maybe I had it this morning, but I probably won't have it tomorrow morning, is the best way to say it. But I had to teach this morning, so it really didn't matter about the block part, because after you get up, and you got to get to school and teach. Fishing a little bit helps. It kind of just relaxes me a lot. How's that?
Would any of you care to chime in on that one as well?
I would agree. Just doing something that is not writing, I think, is helpful when you have writer's block, to stop putting pressure on yourself to write. Because it seems to me that the more pressure, at least from my own experience, the more pressure I put on myself to write, the less likely it is to happen. So I will do other things. Reading helps, but really doing something else completely helps. Folding laundry, taking a walk around the block, listening to music, looking at art, looking at things that are beautiful. I think that's the kind of stuff that helps me more than anything.
Other follow-ups?
I was going to say, you know, after doing all the housework that needs doing and using that as an excuse, I often will think in terms of translation, you know, working. I know French and Spanish well enough to fool around with them in, you know, poems, and that can sometimes get you to feel like you're actually working on poetry, and you really are, you know, and mm-hmm. but also you can kind of lean on somebody else's voice and learn a lot about, for example, long lines or short lines or whatever from another poet, and yeah.
I like to, if I can, spend time around horses or dogs or cats, any sentient beings that don't talk and can be loved and are easily loved. That helps a great deal. And swimming. I love to swim. That's a great way of opening up the mind for me. I do a lot of that.
Well, if I'm blocked and writing is looking intimidating to me, I'll usually take on a major project like build a house. And then build an addition to that house, and then travel to China, and then maybe if I get black and I'm still blocked, I might actually sit down and read and kind of work my way back.
Thank you. Carrie, this one is directed to you, but again, we'll go around the table. Writers are often told to write what you know. Have you ever written or asked students to write about something completely unfamiliar to them? Is it a recipe for disaster or an opportunity for growth and discovery?
This has got to be a question that's come from a student who I have made write something completely unfamiliar to them.
You think?
I do it all the time. Yeah. I have never taught a workshop the same way twice, and so sometimes one of my favorite things to do, whether it's an assignment or for the entire semester, is to make students do research in a topic that they are interested in, that they only know a little bit about. And then to use that vocabulary to figure out ways that they can use it suggestively, metaphorically, figuratively, to talk about universal things that we all know. So I do think it's an opportunity for students to learn. And I also think that it's very important to be uncomfortable when you're writing in a certain way, because I find that students come up with more interesting poems when they are forced to do something that's a little different from what they're used to. And also when they're given guidelines. And so I think that research, having some kind of subject other than what they know, is often helpful. And also because, I don't know, sometimes we don't know very much. sometimes our experiences are kind of limited, or we're only writing about them in a really limited way. So finding more subjects to write about and being forced to collect topics, all of that stuff, I think, can be really helpful. So yes, I make my students do it a lot.
Others?
Well, I recently, well, like 6 months ago, came across, I don't know if it's a definition, but I can't remember the writer who said it, but it was, we write what we don't know about what we know. Mm-hmm. And I liked that, because I feel like there are a lot of things that I couldn't write about. For example, I know I've heard Carrie talking about, like, NASCAR, you know, and I didn't grow up with NASCAR. I really couldn't write. I could write about not knowing NASCAR maybe, or I could force myself to write a poem that wasn't very close to me, that was maybe funny or something like that, kind of an exercise poem, but I really don't think I could get at it from inside. But I could write, for example, just today, I was thinking, many times I've tried to write a hurricane poem, and all of a sudden we have another hurricane situation, and somehow it's connected with my father, who used to be, he used to recite like Whitman's, the Captain poem that everybody thinks isn't that great of a poem, it's just his worst poem, the Captain on the Burning Deck and all that. And he was also somebody who never would leave the house in a hurricane, when the hurricane was threatening, we lived on the ocean, And somehow, I've tried to write a poem about that a zillion times. I'm gonna try again this time around, I write about what I don't know about what I know. I sort of think I know it, but I don't really know it, because if I really did, I could have written about it already, but I'm trying to figure it out. Up there.
I really can't add. I mean, Anne's was what she said. You write about what you don't know about what you know. And like, maybe people misinterpret, write what you know. It doesn't particularly mean it has to happen to you or anything. Mm-hmm. The way I've always understood it is that in anything that you write, there's more than a little bit of yourself scattered all through it. Mm-hmm. So if that's the autobiographical part, but it might not be stuff exactly from your life the way it was, or that you give the emotions that you're familiar with, pieces of them, to characters in the story, and the characters are always composites of whoever they were in reality. And the only other way, like with Write What You Know, or I always tell students, or fully imagine, I couldn't particularly probably write about a stockbroker in New York City without going up there and living a year or two, and which I don't know how I would do that, and getting immersed in the culture so I could understand it and everything. So that's gonna be beyond me. But I could probably take a stockbroker character and put him in the setting that I know. Does that mean that could be within my capacity? And I'll just admit, I'm lazy. There's no damn way that I'm gonna go do a lot of research for that, Just no, it's too much fun to her. There's other things to do, which I know.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. Unless it involves having fun or something, then I just me being there. Yeah,
yeah, I think too that finding what you don't know is maybe sometimes about getting rid of the personal. I mean, Yeats said something about the merely personal rots. It needs to be packed in salt and ice, I think is the way the quote goes. And I think that maybe finding the good work is getting to that salt and ice, pushing maybe the bad drafts are about, too much you, and you need to move away from it.
You know what? I'm so absorbed in listening, I've forgotten what I was going to say. That was fascinating. And I think everything comes from the self. And that's one thing I think I say to students a lot, that it comes from inside oneself. And I was quite serious when I said about reading the Bible and daily and reading it a lot, because everything, all human life and all our human failings are in there. So it's a great place to start studying humanity, I think, and I should recommend it more for students. Human emotions and feelings and love and hatred, those things are within us and we know it. Picking up on what Dale Ray said, I think that's the thing about the stockbroker. That's the thing you need to really do the work. That's if you want to write about something you don't know, that's when you have to do your research, because it shows, as students will attest very quickly, when you don't know about the stockbroker or about the, for example, I wanted to write about horses, and I got the opportunity here at Murray State to ride in the equestrian center, and I began to understand the mind of a horse, which sounds a little silly, but it's actually very, very true. And it's only when you can study something really up close, early every morning, quietly, the magic comes out. But you really have to know it, and it comes from within. But the superficial stuff, like the stockbroker, what the stockbroker does, one has to study that if one doesn't know it.
Squire?
Well, I'm having all kinds of thoughts. I'm remembering, I don't know if I've got it right, correct me if I don't, but I think Flannery O'Connor, the short story writer, fiction writer, said something like this: a writer has everything she needs by the age of 21, all the material she needs. Does that sound about right to the quote? I've always thought that was an interesting sort of perspective on this business of write what you know. Well, you don't know all that much when you're 21, but according to O'Connor, you've got everything you need. And that sort of makes me think that you know more than you know you know. Maybe that's there's a lot of quotes here with the word know in it, in them, but you don't know what you really know, and that writing is a way of discovering that, and writing is also a way of kind of pushing you to find out what you know. The stockbroker stuff, I agree. The stockbroker stuff is research. It's surface material. But maybe you already know something about a stockbroker when you're 21. Maybe you already know that human dynamic that encourages greed or grace or whatever it is that the stockbroker lives by. So writing, the question was originally about teaching. And so when I don't ever tell my students to write about something they don't know, but I do find students doing that, and even if students are writing about something they know very well, personal experience, I will push those students to discover things that the writing is telling them that is not something they already knew. And I'll encourage that in revision. Look at what this story seems to be saying. Well, that's not the way it really happened. Well, let it go that way and see, because this is coming from somewhere other than your conscious, conscious mind. So,
all right. Thank you all. Let's open it up for everyone to address this question. I think it's a really interesting one. What's the line between literature and trash?
I think it's going to be different for everybody. Sorry. I think it's different for everybody. Where I think the line is going to be different from where Martin thinks the line is, and from where Anne thinks the line is, and from Dale and Squire. And I do think there are pieces of literature that are perhaps more valuable and lasting than others, but even those are going to have a lot of debate surrounding them. So I don't know. I mean, I think that's one of those questions that we will talk about, but that, I don't know. I mean, somebody argue with me if you think that there is a line, because I don't know that there is a distinct line that we can point out and say, these are the criteria for great works of literature, and these are the criteria for works of crap. So,
no, I don't think so either. I think maybe that famous line from the pornography case on Ulysses. You know, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. You know, that may apply here. But I don't think trash has much to do with plot lines, really. I mean, if you think about Lolita, for example, you know, this pederast follows a 15-year-old all over the country or whatever. I mean, that might fall into a trash category in some ways, but it certainly doesn't. I mean, it seems to me that something not being trash has a lot to do with form. Dale Ray, as I'm sure many of you know, is famous for saying, take care of the sentence and the sentence will take care of you. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. You really have to know your grammar, and you have to know the way a sentence pulls you into it, and you know you have to know the difference between complex sentence and compound complex and all kinds of stuff. To me, that gets you away from trash. It's the form stuff, you know, thinking about that and being able to work the subject matter in new directions.
Yeah, I was going to say a funny use of language, probably, but the funny answer is John Irvin. Anything on the other side of John Irvin in the novel or fiction form is trash, and anything on the other, on the good side, he's a straddle line right there.
Interesting. I think it's probably
that was funny, didn't
it? It's probably a harsh dichotomy, like literature and trash, because there's probably a big spread there. But I think when something is not terribly good, it's of the moment. And if something is terribly good and is classic and beautiful, it's of all time. And I think that's the difference between something that's can be a good read, but it's trashy. But if it's of all time and it's a classic and it's a work of art, there's somehow. I was thinking about the people who'd entered a competition, the Racer Fiction Writer of the Year, because something has to have transcendence or transformation in it for it to be art, I think.
I don't like the word trash. I don't like the word trash talking about a particular category of books or type of book. I do think there's a distinction between art and entertainment. I think that the line where it becomes art maybe happens something like this. At the funeral, John sat in the chair and stared at the body of his grandfather, and he was really, really sad. And then the next version, where it might push toward art, John sat in the second row at the funeral parlor looking upon the body of his beloved grandfather, and he wondered how much he was going to get in the will. I don't know if that makes any sense or not, but I think that's kind of the where it pushes into the complexity of human reaction and not the easy sentiment defines the line for me.
It might be interesting here to throw out books that were once considered trash.
You know? Yes.
Fiction writers might have a head start in that department. Yeah. I don't know.
You mentioned Ulysses, trash, no band, yeah.
Yeah.
And so with Lolita, trash, no band, yeah, there's a difference in that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And let me think of... Okay, GARP, literature, what it was hailed at, but maybe, I mean, I like, to me, those are books that straddle, that have enormous popular appeal, as they well should. Why would I care? Think about this, the people that make literary book publishing popular, people like Stephen King, because they sell enough copies to make up for the money that literature loses. That model is changing now with print on demand and all that. You'll see a bigger difference than there already is, probably, though I hadn't caught up with it yet, between printing and publishing. There's a huge difference. And that will get blurred on down the road, too, I think. And I believe that the whole whatever is the list will start changing enormously, too, because of the influx of print's going to be rarer and rarer, probably, and Kindles and all those things are going to become more and more and more, so that you'll have, for a while, a control struggle over what is good versus, right now you're just seeing the democratization, or whatever you want to call it, literature. It'll settle out, you know. We just happen to be in a flux period.
Anything to add?
Well, Huckleberry Finn was trash for a while, wasn't it? Didn't it get labeled as trash, as a goofy comic adventure sort of thing until it sort of outlived that? So there you go.
I know it was serialized.
Yeah, it's still on a banned list.
Well, it was banned, but I think it first counted, it was dismissed by a lot of critics as a sort of ruffian backwoods comedy.
An interesting thing to do if you really wanted to answer the question on your own is to go do something like go to the 100 Years of the Best American. Just go look at all the list of the O. Henry Awards that come out every year, and just look at the names that you don't even know who the hell they were, and they were hot at the time. And these would be people that everyone at this table would not consider trash writers. If you want to get depressed, go read that stuff, okay? Mm-hmm. All the names that were really good that you don't know. That's the pill for no fun, really.
I think this leads into another question about why writers don't talk very much about money.
What money? There's no money to talk about.
Next question.
Are
you paying us for this? Hey, nice.
Well, what are your best tips for getting an agent and then working with that agent? Who has an agent?
I do.
Then you need to answer this.
Not if I don't want to.
Fair enough.
I'm sorry, that was belligerent. What? You just need to write. That's all you got to do. If you just sit and write, you'll publish, because if you just keep at it and be the best critic of your own work, then you'll publish without an agent. If I can do it, anybody can. And then agents will write you letters saying, are you, they're taken, it'll sound funny, like you're a virgin or something. And then you just do what they tell you to do. Most of my buddies who have agents, they're on about their fifth or sixth. You kind of go through them a little bit.
I think it is an important question, and it doesn't get talked about much at all. And I lived in New York for 12 years, which is the Shark Tank. And it's an ugly business, and because I think the agent, I had an agent, and it started off wonderful and didn't end so wonderful, which I've heard afterwards is very common with first novels. and first agents. I think, unfortunately, the world of publishing and agenting is very different from the world of writing and doing what one does, creating, for want of a better word, art. And they're at odds. And some people are, but I admire writers who are very good at the business side of writing. I'm not particularly good at it, but I do admire it greatly. But I think it's very, very difficult. I think, you know, the idea of an agent was created to help the writer be protected from possibly an unscrupulous publisher. But what I began to learn after living in New York for many years and getting to know writers and agents really, really well was that that relationship between the agent and publisher is invariably closer than either of those relationships with the writer. A lot of people would not say that on the record, but that is the case. So I always tell the young writer when they're looking for an agent, realize that the business of the agent is to get you as much money as possible, and that's it. And that's fine, but that's all they're going to do. Their relationship and their ongoing relationship is with the publishers. It's never really with the writer. I didn't understand that when I got into the business end of it. And I must say, I find it very uncomfortable and unseemly, but it is what it is. And one has to grow up a little bit and just to acknowledge that it's a part of it, you know. And if you're going to be making, if you're lucky enough to be making money at all, you're going to have to deal with it. And it is unpleasant, I must say. I find it unpleasant.
Other responses to this question?
I have one, although it doesn't involve agents, I guess because I'm in the realm of poetry. But, you know, it seems to me that things have really changed for a lot of younger writers these days. I know when I was in grad school and post-grad school and, you know, trying to get fellowships and all that, the example of Wallace Stevens was held up, you know, that he published Harmonium when he was 40. The example was given of William Carlos Williams, who, for example, you know, published a book too early, The Tempers, and had to go around and, you know, try to scrounge around and find old copies of it so he could burn it so nobody could find it. And now it seems like people are being encouraged to publish every poem they write within seconds, and there's no period of purity where you can just work on your art and think about it and think about who you want to be as a writer. I really do not envy younger writers coming out now, because I think it's so hard. You can be so easily convinced that you're a great writer because you can get stuff out there on the web, and there'll be some bad magazine that will, and there are zillions of them out there that will pick up your work. And, you know, it's a kind of strut your stuff kind of world, partly because the economy is going downhill and publishing companies are going downhill with it. And it's maybe part of what Dale was talking about, you know, this whole flux, and we're, you know, kind of renegotiating the relationship between publishers and writers and readers and all of that. But as a somewhat older writer looking at it, I mean, it just kind of scares me, because I feel like we're getting work out there a little bit before it's ready, and I read a lot of not-so-great work that people think is pretty great. And also, people are up against it. They, you know, there's a chapbook competition in Kentucky, for example, where a lot of writers, you know, if you're, you know, kind of hit that intermediate level, you get into it, right? But then the first thing you need to do is turn around and sucker everybody into buying it, because they won't publish it unless you have so many people. That kind of stuff I don't think is very good for writing, personally, but enough said.
There's one quote that I wanted to say before I forget, when Martin was talking about, like, the public part of it and the business part of it. I think it was Patricia Hampel who said that writing is private life and publishing is literary culture. And I really like the way that she draws the line between those two. I actually have that on my desk at home and in the office to remind me that when I write, it is private. And if it has to stay on the desk for a very long time, then that's where it needs to stay before it goes anywhere. So
that's a wonderful lead-in to another question. And that is, in the process of self-editing, when do you make the decision that your work is ready for someone else to read? What is your revision process? But really, when do you let it go and let other people look at it and say something about it to you?
You learn more about that as you write and do it. I think that it's hard to know whether something is going to fly out in the world without other readers. And you, the more you do that, the more you get other readers, the more you learn when it's done. And the more you learn about your own process, you know, whether you're likely to fool yourself and you're yearning to get it out there and think it's done and it's not done. So sort of paradoxically, you need readers in order to tell you that it's not ready to be read, sort of thing. And you find that. I think every writer's got to have that, and that's how you learn to understand your own work and your own process. So in a class or in a writer's group or however you can do it, I think, and ultimately editors kind of take that role on as well.
There's another question that sort of responds to that, and that's how important is an MFA program to becoming a writer? And maybe it is the safe harbor for others to read and speak of your work.
As the director of the MFA program, I guess I should respond to that, but I'll quote Flannery O'Connor, who said that people complain that MFA programs kill writers. And she said, in my opinion, they don't kill enough. So, and I think that there's some proof to that. And since she said that, which was like in the early 60s or something like that, MFA programs have mushroomed. And I mean, I think that they're a very good thing in a lot of ways, you know, in terms of reading and writing and making friends within writing. And it's getting harder and harder to live the life of a writer. And there's something that goes on there at MFA programs, you know, kind of put a wall around you for 2 weeks or however, you know, a semester, however your MFA program is set up. And it does give you time. But I don't think they make you into a writer. I mean, I know from my own program that most of the people who graduated with me, and it was one of the top 10 programs in the country, are not writing anymore, or you know, maybe even reading. And quite a few of them fell off very fast. So, you know, for people, it's kind of a teaching credential or whatever. And I think that's been a really good thing, you know, especially in terms of programs like ours, where we have a lot of regional people, and a lot of people are doing really well and bringing back, you know, work to us, and I don't know, lots of good things are going on, but I'm not sure that, you know, there's an inevitable famous writer equation, let's put it that way, or maybe even not famous.
Other ideas about the revising process?
Well, on both of those, I don't show my work to anybody, and I would be just too shy until I'm utterly sick and tired of it, and it has to be dead to me. Truly dead. I have to almost have a contempt for it. When I'm done with it, then I'll show it to the agent, or in this case it would be directly to it's sold already, so I'd be sending it to the publisher saying, are you going to give me the rest of the money now? And that would be it. I'm at that with the second novel. I know I'm not that there with the third novel. I realize that I'm such a hypocrite, because the biggest part of my life is with teaching, and which I love very much, and I love the process of teaching much more than the process of writing. And yet I'm such a hypocrite, because I'm getting my students to share their work day in, day out, and very bravely do it and discuss it. And it's something, although I did go to an MFA program, and I would say on that, two of the best years of my adult life were spent in an MFA program, which I loved. It was truly amazing for me, much more so than I thought. So they're not for everyone. They're very easy to knock, MFA programs. It's kind of cool and de rigueur to knock. It's a bit like knocking religion. It's an easy target to knock MFA programs. They aren't for everyone. There's probably too many of them and all of that. But many of the people I know and went through school with an MFA program, it really did help them enormously. And it helped me as a teacher as well. I was already teaching when I became a graduate student. But it really made me I had very good teachers in my graduate school. And it helped me become a better teacher. So it's an amazing thing. I think ultimately you're on your own with the editing and revising, at least for myself, I should say, not for everyone. You have to get to listen to yourself and the voice in your own head talking. And I worry if I share that, other voices bleed in. And I think they can bleed in. In my case, they can bleed in all too easily. And because I'm going after a certain kind of fearlessness, I think I really don't want to be reacting to the world around me at all. I want to go deep in and be oblivious to what's going on around me in the moment. What do you think, Dale Ray? Please speak.
Okay, on the revision stuff, you just revise until yeah, basically you're sick of it. But more than that, until you realize that you can't really do anything else to it. And so I got one friend right here I'll let read. And then send it off. I just did it a couple of weeks ago, sent it to the agent. Got to revise it. But in the meantime, the agent's advice was, sit on this one, give me another one. That way they get stories out of you. And then still, by the time I go back to it, I know the type of revision I need to do. I didn't go through the last revision that I normally go through, which is a drastic revision. I wanted to try it once. No drastic, and it wasn't a great experiment. So, and yes, I believe in MFA programs because I teach, but I kind of really don't. Yeah. If you get one good person, like every 10 years or something, if you can help, you know, somebody's going to be a real writer, get on down the road, then the program's worth it. And I think that the real nice thing about them, everybody that writes is going to know a little bit more about themselves and hopefully be a better person, more humane and everything. So,
were you going to say something a bit ago?
Revision, I guess it works in some ways differently for poets. We just don't have, we don't have like a novel to revise. So my own revision process, I think of and often quote to students, I think it was Hemingway who said that you just have to develop your own internal shit detector. And I think you do that by reading and by listening to your own work. And I'm kind of like Martin at this point. I don't really show my work to anyone. I show my work actually to one poet that I went to graduate school in my master's program with. And I've only just started showing her work again. And the way that we show our work to each other now is much different than we did in graduate school. So I send her a poem and I say, I am having trouble with line 12. That's all I want you to tell me about is line 12. And she respects that. And that's exactly how she asks for help in her own work. So that has been fruitful to me. But I went, when I graduated with my doctoral degree, I'd gone through a lot of workshops and I just didn't want to show my work to anybody else. I was tired of it. But for a long time it was very useful. So I think MFA programs are useful for that. Also, even though you're going to get paid a really crappy stipend at most places, where else are you going to get paid to read what you want to read for 2 or 3 years? It's just not going to happen. Those are like glorious years of your life. You are going to get to come up with this book list of stuff that you want to read, and they're going to give you time and space to do it. I think there's a lot to be said for that. And no MFA program is good. If you're either a writer or you're not, it's whether you have an MFA stamped on your forehead or not is not going to change that. So I think that there are really great programs for a lot of people, and for some people they are a place to go for 2 years. And whether or not you really become a writer is, that's up to you. That's not really even up to it's not up to the faculty. It's not up to your peers. It all just depends on whether or not you put your ass in the chair and make it happen.
Squire, anything to add?
No.
All right. Let's turn it over to Martin Roper now.
Thank you, Kate. This will just take 2 minutes. I promise some of you who I know are busy not that I wouldn't keep you. Thank you very much, Kate, and everyone else here. What I wanted to do briefly was say we're introducing a new competition called the Racer Fiction Writer of the Year. This is the first year of it. And we're going to be running it every year. I've given my commitment that I'll be backing it every year, even though I finish up in May, that it's something I'm going to leave as a gift. It's a thank you to Stacey Stone, to Ted Brown, to Anne Nealon, and Peter Murphy, the people who were responsible and had to endure me for going on 3 years here. So it's my thank you to them. It's been a great time working here. There were 53 applications. Short stories, which is quite a lot when you consider how small the department is, the creative writing majors. Many of the applicants were outside of the department, which was refreshing to see. I hope to narrow it down to 3 stories. I didn't. I narrowed it down to 4 because there was 4 comparable stories, comparably good, I thought. And then I asked 5 separate individuals, 5 judges, without telling them who was who, if they would read them, and then marked them 1 through 4. And that's it. So it was all done very anonymously. They didn't know who was who. They didn't know who the students were, and they didn't know who the judges were. I want to say very quickly to those of you who, not obviously, you know, 51, 52 people are going to be disappointed tonight. Welcome to the club of failure. And to quote a fellow countryman, Samuel Beckett, fail again, fail better. I want to say thank you for applying, because I encourage a lot of students to apply to this, and it is sad not to win something. But your foot is on the road. Those of you who didn't win tonight do have the possibility of getting published in Notations, which is a student-run publication here. And those of you who don't get published in Notations and are rejected, I have another route for you, which is a place where work that has already been rejected can get published. So I really do want to help everyone. I mean that all the students get published. I just want to thank the judges. They don't even know who they are, but I'm going to name them all now. They're from the English and Philosophy Department. Carrie Gerald, thank you. Anne Nealon, thank you. Squire Babcock, thank you. Dale Ray Phillips, thank you. And Dr. Cynthia Gaiman, thank you very much for agreeing to do it as well. So I picked two poets, two prose writers, and a philosopher. I thought that was a very good, eclectic mix. And I was hoping there would be an out-and-out dynamic winner. There wasn't. It was a two-horse race. There were two stories that everyone had rated very highly, and a couple of people had even mentioned thereafter about two stories, and I felt very torn. As you know, there's a $200 prize for the winner, $100 from the university store. Thank you very much to be spent on trade books, $100 from me. And I felt so torn about it and so bad this afternoon when I was going through all the stories. I thought, I felt so bad for the person who was just in second in place. I thought, you know what, it's unfair. So what decided to do is have a second prize, and so there'll be a $50 prize for the person who's second, and I'm going to tell you who that person is first, that the runner-up, the story that was delivered, the reason why it was picked was that it delivered what it promised, and on some level a story is a question looking for an answer. I think a poem is too. The runner-up story delivered very much what it promised, and it evoked the ordinariness and bizarreness of life with force in plain and simple language. In short, it was a story worth reading, and several people had commented on it in various ways. That story is called Baby Doll by Tracy French. So if you would come up here, Tracy, congratulations for being second. Congratulations, Tracy, and you'll be reading this in Notations if she'll allow us to publish it. The winning story, as I say, both stories were noted for having a note of transformation and a moment of being about them. One of the comments that was made to me, a note that was, I really appreciate that some of the judges had written a little note on the story saying why they were particularly moved by them. The winning story had several people commenting, saying that it was a story that had a great emotional presence, and it was a story that evoked a moment of being in a life. Oddly enough, the story does something that if you're in creative writing 101, you'd be told not to do, which is don't use a dream. You know, there's certain things you're not supposed to do. It does indeed use a dream to bring us into the world of the heroine. And the writing is very clean and honest, and it's written by a writer who has great balance on the page. The story is called The End, and it's by Cassie Benson. Congratulations, Cassie. I just said to her that she's surprised, isn't she? Because she's a particularly modest. She's been in a couple of my courses, and she's a particularly modest individual. So I knew she would be, I guess she would be shocked. Congratulations to both of you and to all the writers again. We look forward to it happening every year. The ball is now rolling. Thank you all very much for coming tonight. We're done.